Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, July 15th, 2003. Today's session is Recovery from Grief, Session 1, presented by Corinne Chilstrom, CHC 2003-01. Let's listen in.
I'm glad for all of you who've come, and there are front seats still available. And we're going to spend this hour today talking about general grief and the healing that can happen in grief, and even the growth that can happen to us in time of grieving. The next hour on Thursday is going to be more specific for the issues surrounding suicide, understanding suicide, but more especially to help the grievers, because their grief is very particular. Above and beyond or beside or around or something more than a regular general grief. And then in the evening on Thursday, there's going to be an hour at 5 o'clock for a general discussion where we can tell our stories and share our experiences. I hope there will be some of that as we go along, but there will be more on Thursday evening. I am Corinne Chilstrom. I have been a registered nurse for 30 years, and then in kind of later middle life, went to the seminary and was ordained when I was 53. And so I've been an ordained pastor and have served three congregations, one in the Chicago area, one in Minnesota and early on, and then when we retired, another one in Minnesota. I have developed a real passion about teaching about grief. And the reason is because both in my experience of being a nurse and working with people, and also as a pastor, I have seen so many people turn bitter when they grieve because they don't grieve well. It's like a sense of denying their grief or not being willing to suffer the emotions of grief. And so it's like put on a back shelf and with a feeling that they're just going to go away if I will deny it, but they don't. Those kind of strong emotions take on a life of their own and become almost a prison where we are made captive, and some area of our life becomes actually dysfunctional because we haven't grieved well. And so bad things can happen as a result of it. And so in my experience of helping people grieve, I have learned about these things, but never more than when we lost our son 18 years ago. He was 18, a freshman at Gustavus Adolphus College, came home one weekend and took his life in the family room of our basement while we were sleeping, and we didn't know about it until in the morning. Andrew was such a wonderful kid. All three of our children were adopted, and Andrew, the youngest, had such a need to know who he was. For example, he would say, "I have this name Chilstrom, Swedish, but I am German." And he had such a strong need to know his ancestors and his background. And I will talk some more about those things on Thursday morning, because to be agenerative, as Snyderman, who has done a lot of work with suicide victims, has discovered and writes about, he is a thanatologist, studies death in its many aspects, and has studied a lot about suicide. He says to be agenerative is to be without a past and without a future. And it described so well this child of ours, who was verbal and bright and capable, and yet his life seemed to have no future. And so I often have said that the disease he died from was a lost identity. And that's very sad to me. Parents can do many things, but you can't put in some of those pieces. I'll talk more about that on Thursday. But what I want to say is that the experience of losing a child at age 18 and suddenly was a lesson in grief beyond anything that I had known before. And so at first it seemed like I didn't want to live again and that I wouldn't be able to. And I wondered if I would ever be able to laugh again or to love again. And then when resurrection came, which was truly a gift from God, I sometimes describe it like the description in Genesis, the first chapter, that the earth was waste and void. And that is the best description of what I could give of my spirit when I felt like I was just like an ash heap and that there was no future for me. And yet to pray in hope, as Herb and I did that morning, clutching each other in our bedroom when the house was full of people helping us, praying to God that out of Hebrews, the verse, you know, God, if you could raise Jesus in his darkest hour, can it be and will you give us resurrection too? And, you know, a prayer like that is like, I can't believe it. My faith isn't even a mustard seed, but it's out there. And you've given that prayer to God. And then to begin to experience this life surge to start to happen within you. And to realize you really do want to live, and you think, where is this coming from? I didn't do it. I didn't do anything to make this happen. And yet, life is sprouting inside of me, and it's a new life. And I am growing into, I am being resurrected. And it is such a surprise and a joy and a miracle beyond anything you could have ever hoped for. And so to have experienced that is something that I want to share with people and help people to live again. And then I want to say, and we'll deal with that now in this hour, is to say that most of us, when we think about grieving, think about losing a loved one. But what I want to highlight today also is that there are many other kinds of grieving necessary for many other events and happenings in our life. And we need to know that this is a grief, and we need to be grieving it. Because this thing is not going to go away. It's a power within us that is happening to destroy us if we don't grieve well. So the concept of what I want to do is this piece. We are broken in whatever grief it is, and we can become cynical. And you've seen it, I'm sure, as well as I have. And we can become very bitter. And if we're bitter, I often say, I think we're almost as good as dead. To live bitter is dreadful. And I often pray, dear God, whatever happens in my life, don't ever let me become bitter. But the good news is that we can go to the cross of Jesus, the man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, who came that we might have life and have it abundant. And Jesus is always at the cross, once and for all, waiting for us to come with our burdens, whatever it is. We can give our burden to Christ, and he will take it and will bear it for us. Our sin of whatever. Someone has said our sin is only on two places. It's either on my back or on Christ's. And we don't have to carry it. We can give it away. That's what he offers to us. And whatever heavy burden we have, we can carry it or we can give it to Christ and ask him to carry it for us. But it's hard to go to the cross. It's humbling to go to the cross. And we oftentimes think, well, I just don't need to. I will pretend it isn't happening. But if we go through the cross, we can be whole again. We can live again. And the good news is we can even have joy again. A joy that will be a new kind of joy, one that we never knew before. And it can even be a greater joy than we knew before. We can have a new kind of a courage. It's a new kind of a life. It's a kind of a different person. But we can live again because of the cross. Now, the American way is to deny the need for grieving. And that is said by so clearly by Douglas John Hall, who wrote God and Human Suffering. And he says that it is the American way, and we want a cheap hope and a quick fix. And he gives the example of the play of Arthur Miller, The Death of a Salesman. Some of you probably are acquainted with that. In the play, Willie Loman is the salesman, and he is pathetic, not because he suffers, but because he denies his suffering. And so he projects terrible things out onto his sons and really brings harm to them. And so Hall says in his book that you and I, if we decide to deal with grief in that way and deny our suffering, then he says that three things will happen. First of all, we cannot articulate our own feelings. We refuse to articulate those feelings. Secondly, I'm not going to let you say your feelings either. I will shut you up and I will change the subject if you ever start talking about anything like that. We'll talk about the weather or something. And those of us who have been in grief have experienced this. Some people that would surprise us. We thought that they might be understanding, and they didn't want us to express any of those feelings. Then the third thing that will happen to us, we won't express our own feelings. We won't let another express their feelings of grief. The third thing that happens, though, is a dangerous one, and that is that we begin to project. Remember, this grief isn't just going to disappear. It's taking on its life, a life of its own. It's powerful, and we start projecting, and things come out sideways. We hadn't really intended it, but that's where the energy is going to go. And so we will do bad things to people on the sides, even nice Minnesotans will do bad things to people on the side. I'll give you an example. And most of everything I'm going to say today is in a book I wrote. Shortly after Andrew's death, and I had given some talks, and the book editor of Augsburg Fortress came to me and asked me if I would write a book. And I promised I would. I knew I would, and I knew I could, but I didn't know it would take me 8 years to do it. I had a lot of things to work through first. So I wrote a prospectus. I wrote names of chapters almost immediately. But then it got put on a shelf. And when I got at it a few years later, I had an energy, almost like a call from God to do this. And it happened actually quite fast once we got the first olive out of the jar. And when it was being published, my book editor called me one day and said, this is one of the fastest books that has gone through the publishing process at Augsburg. And I said, oh, it's probably because the churchwide assembly is going to be in another month or so, and you probably want it for marketing. And she said, no. She said, it's because it's going to be a very important book for the church. And I thought, oh my, how could that be? And yet, call I experienced writing it is connected, and now I understand, because since its publication, I have continued to get letters and phone calls from people thanking me, because they have said that's the book that's helped them in their grieving. And so I now understand why the call I felt while I was writing it, almost like power helping me do something that I was beyond my own awareness. It was a real experience to do. I don't think they have many of them in the bookstore. They failed to get the 30 I had asked for, but they do take orders. And this is the Augsburg number. You could call an 800 number if you're interested in buying one. So we're talking about the problem of denying that we need help, and that is clear from what other people have written as well, that it is important not to avoid grief. And this person, Hodge, had written that if the grief work is not actively pursued, the process may be fixated, aborted, or delayed. And we have the feeling that we have escaped it. However, almost certainly a distorted form of grief work will appear at some time in the future. He said, we try to avoid the emotion necessary for grief, but the result is pathological grief. And then he goes on to say that normal grief is a reintegration process of the intellectual awareness of the loss and the physical and emotional effects drawn together into healing. So it's dangerous not to grieve well. One of you mentioned to me about children's grief, and that could be at least an hour to talk about. I simply have one sheet here. I don't have a handout for you, but there are studies about, and it's very helpful to know the variables at different age levels of what a child understands about grieving. A 2 to 3 year old, for example, explanation doesn't help. They simply need warmth and security. They need play. They need interest in their world. And the only kind of thing they can understand is to say, your grandpa can't come to you anymore. And on into all the different age levels through age 12, and then into adolescent. It's not cool to grieve when you're an adolescent. You shouldn't look sad. So you should get over it real fast. I know after our son died, his girlfriend was really having a struggle. And his mother called me one day and said, I'm really worried about Julie. And I said, well, tell her to come over. She knows her way here. And so she started coming over almost every day after school for a while. And her thing was, 3 weeks after his death, the kids thought, why are you still acting this way? Well, it isn't cool to be sad. And she couldn't think, she couldn't study, and she was suicidal. She finally, you know, that's what came out. And so we were really glad that we got her talking, and gradually she started the healing process. And in the spring, she was off with her family on spring break and came back brown as a berry, and soon she had another boyfriend. But to watch the healing of an adolescent. But it doesn't happen easily with your peers when you're an adolescent, because they do not understand you. So let us think then about one of the things important, an important help we learn is lament psalms when we are grieving.
You want us to get the lights?
Maybe we should take the lights out now. You could see this better, couldn't you? The lament psalms are so helpful because they give us words to cry out. And they help us to pray honestly. And, you know, as someone has said, that an honest prayer is really the only prayer. It is very amazing how that lament psalm that someone has written long ago gives us the words to pray. And it helps to break down our isolation and to cast our agony on God. And this is just a few examples. This would be some examples of a lament psalm. And there are some psalms that are also in other places, like Jeremiah and Lamentations. And what you find in a lament psalm, that it starts out crying out, oh God, it's almost like a groaning prayer. And the very act of saying God's name already begins to open something that's closed up in grief. So saying God's name even is a beginning. And then cry out our grief, and then start to think about what God has done in the past, the power and the might and the help of God through history. And then the psalmist starts to take that into his present situation, as we do as we meditate on this psalm. And it's like, then God can help me also. And the lament psalm always ends with, then new trust is born. It's like a cycle from I don't know how to pray, and now that God enters into our need and a new sense of trust is born. And so that's something that happens to us in the there is a power in these psalms of lament. And then I like these pieces. Klaus Westermann, a theologian important in the church from Germany, said, once we've had our opportunity to say our piece, in other words, to get out these feelings of grieving, then we're better able to hear the good news that God has heard our plea and God will come to help us. It's a gift of faith that we know that God is now helping me, and I'm not alone in this. And something is happening to unlock us from grief that spirals us down. And if we don't use a prayer like a lament psalm or a hymn, the hymns have been so important to me through the years. The one we're going to sing right after the sermon tomorrow night is one of them, How Sweet the Name of Jesus Sounds. That's one of the things that has helped me through this. And to have words to pray, because if you don't, you're just groveling in your own little circle, almost spiraling down. But to have these kind of words lifts us in hope to God, and there is new life, and there is future happening. God has heard our plea and will come to help us. It's like a knowing. And then Luther, I love this, don't just sit and brood, but lift your eyes, take a psalm, pour out your troubles with tears before God. He wills that you be too weak to bear and overcome such troubles in order that you will find strength in him, and that he be praised through his strength in you. And this is how Christians are made. You know, that's what the Apostle Paul says. I have done a lot of things, but that's not where my boast is. He suffered enough to know. And so he said, my boast is in the Lord Jesus Christ. He suffered until he knew that he was too weak to bear and overcome his own troubles, and that he had to find his strength only in one place, and that was in Jesus Christ. And Luther said, well, that's how Christians are made. I think about one of our friends who is a bishop in one of our synods, who was telling us one day about one of his young pastors. And he said these words. He said, he will be a fine pastor someday after he has suffered. There's some maturing that happens, that can happen when we suffer. Now, I mentioned that we were going to talk about the many different kinds of things. We won't talk about them all, but some of them. That grief is a common thing. And so we are all grievers. All of us here today are grievers. There is something that probably we should be grieving about, even right now. And I have just four categories that will at least start to open it up to us. But to think about, whenever we meet one another, we look into each other's eyes and heart, and you kind of wonder what's going on in your life right now. And we may have had some of these experiences, like a loss of possessions, bankruptcy, unemployment, foreclosure. Maybe you've just sold your home that you've been in for many years and loved. Maybe a pet has died, a natural disaster, and many other things. I often like to include losing your car keys. Panic, chaos. And you could add many, many more things to that. So ask people what's going on with them, and you might be surprised. It might be something that needs a little grieving. or the lost parts of self. Those of us who have a few years behind us know about these things, a body part or function, loss of some part of our health or our role as a parent or a spouse. And you know, that's an interesting thing, the role thing. When we lose a spouse, and I learned a lot about this when I worked in hospice years ago, there is the grief of the person, but there's also the grief of the role that person played for us. Maybe I can't drive. Maybe I'm the husband and lost my wife and I don't know how to work the washing machine. Some husbands don't know. Well, and on and on. I mean, we play roles in our life, and so it's a loss of a person, but it's also what did they mean to you in the things they did that made a difference in your life? So that's a thing to talk about. And then financial security might be lost, or expectations. And a lot of us who are older parents, I've talked with several people already in 2 days here about this very thing, a loss of an expectation for a child or the dream that you had for the future. What if one of your children starts to show signs of mental illness? You never dreamed of such a thing. What if one of your children turns out to be gay or lesbian? You never dreamed of such a thing. Not only do you worry about their life and the persecution they might have to experience in this wonderful land of America, but you will probably never have any grandchildren. Maybe you have a child that, you know, showed such signs of hope, and they decide that they won't go on to college, and you, of course, expected all of them to go to the college where you did and to excel and do well. Whatever. You could go on and on about expectations, but not only for children, for yourself, too. I mean, sometimes life just doesn't turn out like you thought it would. Sometimes the disappointment is great, and it needs to be grieved. Or the loss of fertility, which was something that my husband and I experienced when we had come from large families, and we never ever thought of such a thing. Of course, we were going to have 4 children, and they were going to be they were all going to have signs of the one we loved, and we dreamed, and then it wasn't happening. And when we started fertility studies, and they weren't like they are now, not as expensive either, but there was the roller coaster up and down and up and down. And I remember we were in Pelican Rapids. It was Herb's first parish, and this was very real at that time. And I was really angry at God. And I can remember we had this little garden plot out at the edge of town, and I can remember this beautiful June day, and I went out and sat on this warm rock, and I had my fist in God's face, and I was so angry at God. How could you do this to us? And God had done this to us. My theology has changed a whole lot since then. But, you know, getting the anger out was the beginning of the change, and that was really helpful. Because God heard my anger, and it went to the cross, and that's why Jesus died, was for angry things like that. And then we got ready for adoption, and so that was a development of its own. But then developmental losses, the status as an only child. A child cut off from now the parents' financial support. Graduation time, loved that college and loved all those classmates, roommates, and everything, and now that's all gone. And or when a child leaves home or for retirement, there are losses in each of these things. And then finally, the loss of significant others. Maybe a friend moves away, a role model dies, or a hero, or the breaking up of lovers, losing a spouse by divorce or death, losing a parent or a grandparent, or losing a child. So these are just some of the many different kinds of losses that we experience that do need grieving. And then this is one more example of how grief hollows us out, as it were. And I like to show this as a, can you all see, or am I in your way? Move your chairs. This circle in the center being ourself, and then things start to happen. Maybe we lose our house, a foreclosure, or just simply moving, or then some health issues, and watch how it hollows out the identity of the person we are. Maybe we lose a job. In these days of unemployment and the pink slips, that's happening to lots of people. We maybe have a change in our financial security, and that has happened to many people in these days as well. Or to lose a spouse by divorce or by death, to lose a child. And you know, some parents have lost more than one. With Hall's in St. Peter, he was a theologian. They had four children, and they lost all of their children. One was Camille, who died in that Symbionese Liberation Army out in California. They are all buried in our cemetery there in St. Peter. And those two parents lost all of their children. This Camille was the last one, but their other three all died of unusual diseases, two of them of a genetic disease when they were 11 and 12. And it just was strange to keep meeting them after all of those four graves were there in St. Peter. So how difficult for some. Well, I like to use this, some of these things, to say that, and this is the way I like to say it, that grief is not just one big thing, not just a single thing, but it's made up of many pieces. And it's like a ball of tangled yarn. And you know how hard it is to get at a piece and to get it started out? It's just tight in there somewhere. Yeah, but if you find an end and start to pull on it, then gradually you can get the tangle unloosened. And I think grief is like that, because once you get one piece coming loose, you can deal with that. You can start to talk about it, each feeling as it surfaces, and you're on your grief journey then. Macbeth, so long ago, said that you have to give sorrow words, because the grief that does not speak whispers the o'erfraught heart and bids it break. So well put together, those words. Now, strange things do happen if we don't grieve. I've mentioned it before, and I'll keep mentioning it, because it is so important to grieve. And this is an instance of something that happened in childhood. I once had a professor who, when he spoke or lectured or preached, he often cocked his head in a certain way, and he had an expression of anger on his face. And he would sit in the classroom or in a congregation where he was preaching, and you would have the feeling that he was angry at you. And I mean, you knew he wasn't, but it felt that way because of his body language, both of the way his head was turned and the expression on his face. I didn't know him very well until I was at a conference where he was speaking once, and it just happened at a meal that I was sitting next to him. And you know how you start getting acquainted, you find out where people are from and a little bit about their background and everything. And I don't know how it happened that it just came out. He said, well, my mother died when I was 5. And I said, oh, my. What was a parent. And he looked at me kind of strange. And then he said, "You are the first person that's ever asked that question of me." And then very contemplative, he sat there. And tears started streaming down his face. And he just started talking about his mother. I said, "What was she like?" And he told about remembering sitting on her lap and her love and warmth and her reading to him. And then she had, I think it was a brain tumor, and became very ill. And then she died. And I said, what do you remember about the day she died? And do you remember any feelings?" And he said, "Oh, yes, I do." In fact, he said, "I remember going out into the front yard." I think he said he was five. And he said, "I remember looking up at God, and I just felt so angry at God. I can't believe it, but I'm looking at the same face, the same body language that you have when you're in a pulpit or in a classroom." I couldn't believe the similarity as he told the story of this feeling. And that's what brings me to what I had earlier, quotation from Hodge that says, "If we don't grieve, we become fixated and the grief becomes pathological." This is a primary example of fixation, because even his face expression and the tilt of his head as he connected to 5-year-old angry at God was exactly the same. And so he just talked a lot about this whole experience, and he said, "You know, what a relief at last." And he said, "I don't know why I'm crying, because that happened 50 years ago. It's because it was fixated." And I said, "Well, if those tears are still in there, they better come out sooner or later." And so it seemed like it's happened that he came around me whenever I was in the area. It was like, here's a safe place I can talk about this. And so this fixation is not just something on paper. It's very real. And just not very long ago, our neighbors are discussing a person that's in their extended family, and I know that she lost her mother when she was 10. And from what they're dealing with, I said to her the other day, "You know, I just know that this weird stuff that's going on is somehow related back to 10-year-old. There's some kind of fixation here. I would just love to sit down and talk with her someday and see what would come out, because there's something that needs to be unlocked by somebody." So that's serious when there is a fixation. Now, some other things that we should say about giving sorrow words is that we haven't been always encouraged by professionals to do this. In fact, it hasn't been so very long ago that grief was considered a real pathology, a sickness. And the way you get over sickness is to take pills for it, and to just get up and get going and put it in the past. And I just wanted to mention that in the 1980s, there was a survey done of Illinois physicians who said that the appropriate grief intervention was barbiturates and sleeping pills. After I had written this book, I had a telephone call one day from a woman in Iowa who had been doing just that, and she said, "Your book is what makes me realize I am going to stop taking all that stuff, because when I am awake at night, I guess I need to be grieving rather than forcing myself to go back to sleep." And I thought, aha! So I wrote back to her and I said, "Well, I just pray that you can have a good grief in the middle of the night when you can't sleep. And that's a better healing than pills." But doctors have in the past done this. Now, it may be important on occasions, but not as a routine. But 85% of those physicians did say that they prescribe tranquilizers, barbiturates, and antidepressants for grief, because it's an illness. It was then around the year 1965, when things did start to change in the English-speaking language, there were two men, Cullen Parks and John Bowlby. You will recognize these names from other grief writings. But they researched 1,200 widows in London, and they wanted to know what a normal grief process was about. And I'm going to show you some of their results, but they wrote up some things, and it was in the New England Journal of Medicine, and it was for the first time in the English language that words like these were written, that grief is not only a good thing, but it's necessary. It's not an illness, it's a necessary thing. It's both healthy and necessary. When we grieve, when we're in hard grief, we really get disoriented. And I know something about that. The day that Andrew died was the most draining day that I can imagine, and then the next day also. It happened early on a Sunday morning, and that day our children got home, one from Arizona and one from Madison, Wisconsin. And my sister got on the plane with, she was his godmother too, he was at the university down there, and she had the good sense to get on the plane with him and come. And I didn't know how much I needed her. But there's something about disorientation when you're in the shock of early grief. And disorient, the person who taught me about this is Glenn Davidson in a book, Understanding Mourning. And he says that disorient, orient means to face east. And if you're disoriented, you don't know where east is. And that is truly what happens to you when you are in the terrible shock of grief. Well, to tell you what happened, it was Monday then, the day after this death of Andrew, and we were going down to St. Peter to make funeral arrangements and to empty his college room. Mary and Chris needed to do that. That was their thing to do. And we had a borrowed van. Herb had borrowed this van to bring some wood home from his brother's place. He has a retarded brother, and he was out helping him cut down a tree and things. And so the seat was out of it because he brought wood home in it. So we were, and that was good because we were going to bring Andrew's college stuff home, you know, chair and all the stuff they have in their college room. So Mary and Chris were going to each sit on a sleeping bag in the rumbling around in the back of this van. And so here comes my sister, Devona, with another sleeping bag, and she's going to sit back there writing this hour down to St. Peter. And we said, well, you don't need to go with us. And this sister of mine is, she's not as, I don't know, forthright or loquacious as I am, or she's more quiet and reserved. But she has a good sense of what needs to be done always. And she just said, well, I'm going to come with you. And how she knew she needed to, I don't know. And I certainly didn't know it. But what happened was, when we were making funeral arrangements, we also had to go into the coffin room to pick up a coffin. And that was a terrible experience for me. Because I stood looking at those coffins and I could care less. I didn't want to buy them. And I didn't. The only thing I could think about was children's beds that I had always loved to wash sheets and hang them out so that they smelled like the outside fresh air, and they would say, oh, my sheets smelled good last night, Mom, you know, and things like that. And so making beds after I washed sheets was always a special piece of mother love, and to think about a coffin was, so I just turned my back. And so if any time I had been disoriented, I was. I didn't know where east was, but there was my sister right beside my shoulder, and it was as though she were holding me up, and it was like I needed somebody who knew where east was. She was at one of these sessions once, and she came to me afterwards, and she said, I didn't know where East was that day either. But the other thing that we learn about grief, you know, and you read from many, many helpful people, another one is Buechner, is Frederick Buechner wrote a book, Sacred Journey. And in that book, he said a sentence that I think is so helpful. He said, grief is like having your house burned down. And it takes a long time before you know what all you've lost. It would, wouldn't it? That came home to me after the flood, the 97 flood up in the Red River Valley, and I was asked to come up to Grand Forks to preach one Sunday, and I visited with a lot of people, and one of the ladies told me that next winter, she said, I went down in the basement to get my boots when we had a big snowstorm. And she said, I started looking, and then I thought, they're gone. My basement was flooded. My boots are gone. And so, you know, it takes a lot of seasons, a lot of experiences after major grief before you know what all you've lost. And that continues to happen through the years. In my experience, losing a child, you know, his brother graduates from law school. Pomp and circumstance is playing, and there we are celebrating. All of a sudden, the tears because he should be here. And last June 1st, we had a big wedding for our daughter. It was her first wedding, and she's 41 years old. And Mary and Andrew were very close. And on the altar is a rose. And he should be here. He certainly should be here. So, you know, this just comes like waves again and again and again. And you can go for several days when, you know, it goes pretty well, but then the wave comes and hits you. And we are here with our daughter and her new husband and his two children. So this is a very happy week for us. But just on last Friday before we left, and Herb is a master gardener, he has a big garden in the shape of a heart with flowers in it as you enter the cemetery there. And that's his loving volunteer service for the cemetery where Andrew is. And he had been out to give it a good watering before we left last Friday. And he came in the door, and as I often say to him, how's everything? It kind of touches, and that brings out. And here I realized he was sobbing because he had stopped at Andrew's grave, and it would be nice to have him with his children here today, this week too. So, you know, it just keeps going, and you have to keep going to the cross again and again and give it to Jesus. Well, now let me, now I'm a nurse again for a few minutes. And I have been very curious about the pathology of what happens to us when we grieve, because, you know, we learn that there is a high percentage of certain illnesses when you're in major grief, like 200% higher incidence of myocardial infarction. There's a high incidence of colon cancer, and on and on. How come? There are many, many more visits to doctors, hospitalizations. How come? Well, I found some things in a book by Hans Selye about the stress of life, and he had this little chart that I found so fascinating. He says when we have a stressor, it sends messages to the hypothalamus. It's a little relay center right in the center of our brain, which then in turn sends a message to the pituitary gland, also in the center of the brain, very tiny but important, and that triggers the endocrine system, which sends chemicals just all over the body, not through any certain avenues, but it just spurts out all over the body. Our bodies are so miraculous. And that tells the adrenal glands what to do. They're two little glands sitting right on top of the kidneys in the back. And The adrenal glands then tell the stomach, the lymph glands, and the white blood cells what to do. So we've got this stress going on, and our blood pressure is going up, our heart rate is going fast, and one of the messages that goes to the stomach is you've got to get more acid flowing because things are happening out here. And it's almost like if you think about a warship and everybody is washing the deck and they're shining and polishing everything, and suddenly they see a warship on the distance, and so there's the urgent message, all hands on deck, so stop all your cleaning and oiling and greasing things up and making things go well, because we've got an enemy to fight. And in a sense, that's what our body is doing when we've got a stress or a grief. So the stomach gets up in a knot, a lot of acid, we might get an ulcer. The white blood cells fight infections, you know. And so they're supposed to stop working now. And so we could have more infections. The immune system, it might go down, and we could, the cancer cells we normally are fighting off, suddenly we can't. And then, of course, the lymph glands fight infections too, and they're not working like they're supposed to work because we've got this stress we're also concerned about. So my question is then, how do you get these arrows to start going the other way so that our body begins to be experience healing and to work the way it's supposed to work again? Well, here now is what I've referred to before about the natural, necessary mourning process. And this is out of the work of the two men that I mentioned before, Parks and Bowlby. After they worked with 1,200 widows in England. And they first went out on the street and just asked people, how long do you think a major grief lasts? And the average answer was 3 weeks. And those of us who grieve know that that's just the beginning, and that is what they tell us. They said that the beginning of mourning is 2 weeks. It's a root experience. You are cut off at the roots, and that a new plant will grow, but it will be probably a very different plant. They described the shock and numbness, the tight, long muscles that you have, and that then peaks again years later, and then at significant dates or significant happenings, as I've just described, a graduation of a sibling or a wedding of a sibling or coming to Holden Village when they can't come with you. So significant moments bring back, and you are almost for a while again in that beginning stage. Then the second stage they describe as a searching yearning, and it lasts, they said, from 2 weeks to 4 months. And it's when we have a pining, an absolute obsession, and we are depressed and feel crazy because we hear that loved one coming. There were times when I could just about hear the ba-dump-ba-dump-dump, you know, down the steps like a teenager goes, you know, missing most of the steps. Or you would be someplace, we were in Germany, and we were in a hotel, and I looked up on a balcony, and I saw somebody that looked so much like Andrew that I was almost, is he really up there? Could he be possibly there? But you feel crazy when that thought goes through your mind, and the reason is because you want it so much. And they described widows who said that at 5 o'clock they would hear a key in the door or the garage door going up. And that just know that when you have those feelings, you might feel crazy, but you aren't. It's a very normal thing that might be happening to you. Then they describe the non-compliance stage, which would be 4 months and beyond. When you feel very disorganized and depressed, it's a physical depression where if your body had been at the same pitch of grieving as at the beginning, your body would probably just collapse. And so your body just says no. And so instead it just feels like every cell in your body feels depressed. And so many times at funerals you hear people, well-meaning, say, you know, if there's anything I can do for you, call me. And it's wonderful for the offer, but do you know that at this stage we can't? We're too depressed to call somebody and ask for something. And we might not even want to be with people because we don't like people to see us if we're not feeling well or if we're feeling depressed. It's like, no, I'm looking too awful. I'm acting too awful. I had the experience, it was a pastor that I had done my student work when I was at the seminary, and they became really good friends of ours, had children the same age. Some of them were adopted too, and we had a lot of things to share. He was one of the very special people in our grief journey. He had called me one day and wanted to go out for lunch, and yes, that would be good. But when the day came, I felt so depressed, and I thought, no, I don't want him to see me this bad often. So I just called and said that I wasn't able to make it. I was sorry. And so he said, right away, he said, well, then I'm coming anyway, and I'm going to pick you up. And you know, that was the best thing, because he knew this kind of thing. He knew about these things. And so we sat down over lunch and talked, and it was exactly what I needed. But we need somebody at this time to just say, can I pick you up and we'll go and we'll do this. One of the hardest things for people when they lose a spouse, I'm told, is going back to church alone. They've gone to church all these years together, and now to sit alone in church is just, they can't. And to kind of take someone by the arm and say, let me sit with you every Sunday for a while or something. You know, it's a wonderful thing. Or let us, on Sundays, let's go out for lunch together, or come to our house, or let us. Sundays are the hardest times for widows and widowers, I'm told. Sundays, weekend times. There's kind of a routine in the week, but weekends are so hard. And so the job we're doing is to integrate the consciousness with the subconscious. And then the watershed is finally 24 months for normal adult grieving, when there's a sense of the release, renewal of energy, stable eating and sleeping again, but then a great swing on certain times that might happen. Time is soon up. So what can you do? Get in touch, run to the griever, and waste no time. If you can't go there physically, use the phone and at least send a card. I've written a whole lot about that in a book, one chapter. There were four people we never heard from. After all these bushels of cards, I said to her one day, you know, there are four people we never heard from. And he said, there are four. And he named the four. That's a story all of its time. I don't have time to tell you. But what happened in our contacting each of them, the results of it, were very interesting. And some of them were very close to as a result. Listen, say little, and no advice, no platitudes or whys, but your presence is what's important. And that's what you remember years later. I can close my eyes and see the lines of people coming, even still. And the remembering of their presence still blesses me from coming to us at that time. And then keep in touch, draw out feelings, keep listening, help each other tell the story. And then the practical help. Food and fluid intake, and exercise. That's a biggie, because if we sit slumped and don't use our muscles, there's a kind of chemical that encompasses us that makes us depressed in and of itself, even if there isn't a grief. And when we get out and use our long muscles, then we get those endorphins working and secreting, and they give you a sense of well-being. And so exercise is one of the very important things to do. And then, you know, tell us when we need to eat and drink. When you're in shock, you don't even know that. And then avoid pity. That's not the field of pity of people. And then share memories, especially with children, share pictures and help them talk. write a letter remembering events, and then share silence, because when a griever needs to tell you something, it takes a while to gather what you need to say. So get comfortable with silence, and then help us return to our work and social life, and then regular worship. The songs and the scriptures and the practice of giving our burdens to Jesus, the hymns and the prayers of others are so helpful to have had already when we come to such a time, and then to bear one another's burdens. And finally, the goal of grief is something that I have coined as to help the heart know what the head knows. I knew that first morning that Andrew was dead, but my heart wouldn't believe it, and it took me months to believe it. So that's what the grief journey is for, to acknowledge change and then to begin a new life. I want to close with just a couple of things here, and this is the first one. Grief is a friend. Yes, we've been wounded and limp, but there is a power, and when we grieve, that we can learn at the cross to let go the anger, the sadness, the self-pity, to let it go and to then think, I can know happiness again. It will be new. It will be with shadows. And then finally, we become thankful for what we've had and then released from the obsession of what we've lost. We can start to enjoy life again. We become friends with our new self. And then through it all, we learn compassion. Pity distances, but compassion. We learn compassion for others, and we can see it a long ways away, and we can echo that compassion with one another as we, when we grieve well. And so we do wish one another the gift of good grieving, and that becoming happens only through a struggle. And then this last is a quote from the funeral service in our Lutheran Book of Worship. When we give our suffering through Jesus Christ to God and then receive the body of Christ who encompass us to help us through this time. The church is the body of Christ. It is Christ with skin on. And I want to read this, but before I do, I want to tell you the story that Michael shared with us, Thompson, who has been in Jerusalem, who told us about being unchurched, their family was. His mother died after a lot of smoking, died suddenly of lung cancer, living in the East, and he said they weren't a part of any church. But there was a Lutheran church nearby that they went to for help. And he said, do you know that the people from that church all came to the funeral? And he said, those strangers, he said, we can't tell you what happened to us when all those strangers became our friends and surrounded us at the funeral of our mother. And he said, that's how I came into the church. That was my entrance to the church, the body of Christ. And Herb and I think we loved the church and the body of Christ before, but never like after the experience of all of the people who surrounded us and held us together when we had fallen apart and were the body of Christ for us. And so this has become such a precious piece from 1 Corinthians. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the source of all mercy and the God of all consolation. God comforts us in our sorrows so that we can comfort others in their sorrows with the consolation we ourselves have received from God. Isn't that wonderful? Thanks be to God. Our time is over, and so we'll do something on suicide and understanding the particular needs of survivors on Thursday morning. And then what we didn't get to do was to share, no. But there will be a time on Thursday at 5:00 in this room. So if any of you can come then and share things we need to hear from you. So I'll look forward to that hour with you all, too.